Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to get started, even though I think a lot of people are going to come yet, because I'd like to cover as much as possible. It's warmer today, so I had to turn the air on, so I apologize. I hope you're able to hear me okay, because sometimes the air conditioner can be quite loud. For those of you who are new, there are worksheets on that sheet in the or on that table in the entrance there. And I would like to, since chapter 5 is a little bit shorter chapter, I'd like to do a little bit more on chapter 4, because there were one or two questions that were quite significant that we didn't cover last time. So let's begin about Daniel 4, verse 30. And let's begin with prayer. Lord Jesus, we thank you for your word. You have given it to your people in such a variety of ways. Today we are going to see how you miraculously put the writing on the wall for the Babylonian people to show them how their kingdom had come to an end because of their arrogance and refusal to admit that you are the one in control. Teach us more about that truth today, Lord. We need to understand more fully how you are in control of our entire lives and that we are not kings of our own destiny. Teach us your word and bless us as we study it together. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, please have a seat. There are three worksheets that we're working with because I would like to finish up from chapter 4. From last time, we didn't get as far as I would have liked. We got as far as the Thursday reading. This is in the worksheet for chapter 4. We got to the Thursday reading, and we came to number 2 is where we'd like to start out.
I'll read the section. It begins at verse 30.
Daniel 4, verse 30. Well, let's start at the beginning of the paragraph. All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" The words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. At the end of, let's see, is that the end of, yeah, that's the end of the section for Thursday. Let's just consider those questions chapter 4. We had gotten as far as number 2. Read Nebuchadnezzar's words in verse 30. What had he obviously not learned from his latest dream or from any of the preceding events recorded in the book of Daniel? Do you find this surprising? If so, why? How would you characterize Nebuchadnezzar here? Ego, Joyce is voicing to me. He's egotistical, right?
Man with a very short memory.
Man with a very short memory, right? An egomaniac, Gail said. Why would we find this surprising that at this point, we're at, toward the end of chapter 4 here, he's still speaking that way? What had gone on earlier in the chapter?
He was the boss.
He was the boss, that's true. But what should have already given him his comeuppance? You're all ready for chapter 5, huh? Can't remember chapter 4. Joyce. What was the second dream? The tree, right? First, the statue fell down. That was a symbol of the Babylonian power. It collapsed. Chapter 4 was about the dream where there was this huge tree reaching to heaven. And the tree got chopped down. And when Daniel was brought in to interpret the dream, he said, "You're the tree, Nebuchadnezzar. You are going to be chopped down because of your arrogance, your refusal to admit that the Lord is the Almighty." So he's already had the dream, the interpretation of the dream, and now he falls into this sin of arrogance? What's up? Is this surprising or is it not surprising? He's been forewarned.
Just not listening.
I would say it's not surprising. I mean, I was trying to think of a good example, but how many teenagers here don't drive talking on a cell phone or don't drink and drive, and you always think it's not going to happen to me?
Yes, exactly.
And so we all do it.
We're all like Nebuchadnezzar, aren't we? We get told again and again what our faults are, what's going to happen to us if we do such and such, and we do it anyway, right? Here's a little example that I've learned from my experience. When it comes to my health, there are certain things that I know I shouldn't do, but I forget from year to year. So I've started a document in my computer simply labeled health, where I have certain things written in there with exclamation point. Do not water ski, exclamation point. I forget from time to time the damage that gets done to the back. How I agonize around here. It's human nature to forget these things, right? Give me more. Why would a man like Nebuchadnezzar have this problem remembering? Joyce. He's used to people kowtowing to him, right? And so he thinks he can say these things, even though he's been warned by God not to say these things. So when you first read it, you think, did the guy get the first part of the chapter or not? But the more you think about it, it would be natural for these, these unlimited rulers. They had no constitutions like we know them to curb their power. They were absolute monarchs who were just used to taking credit for everything. So he gets up on top of that house of his and he says, "Oh my goodness, look at Babylon, and I'm all to be thanked for it. I'm completely responsible for it." Let's go on to the next question. Number 3. Apply this to yourself. Well, I think we've answered this one, huh? Have you ever failed to learn an important lesson that God had taught you? If you're comfortable with it, be prepared to share it with the class. Did anybody have a particular one they wanted to share? Besides the water skiing, I wrote down another one. A few years ago at church here, we were having a problem with the roof on the church. The shingles were flying off every time we had a winter storm. I was petrified at the time, thinking the shingles are going to hit the kids. The shingles would come off and they dig into the asphalt. They were hitting so hard, and I was always fearful. You know, kids coming in and out of school. So I was praying constantly, "Lord, don't let anybody get hurt before we can replace this roof." We replaced the roof, and last January, I was smugly saying to my wife, "I can rest so much easier knowing that the church roof is replaced. I know this is a horrendous storm that we're supposed to have today, but no more worries." She called me back up about an hour later and said, "The shingles are coming off the house." And I went right back to where I started from, not trusting the Lord. Oh, Lord. And so I had to learn the lesson again. The lesson turned out perfectly again because my insurance, well, that day I just agonized. We were up there with the tarps, you know, covering over the roof. But within a month, I had a good insurance company. It paid for the whole roof and put on gutters, which also needed replacing. And I had a $500 surplus. And I learned once again after a day, a week, a month of not trusting in the Lord and agonizing, oh, how could this happen to me, that the Lord always takes care of his people. We have to learn these lessons over and over again. What is it about us?
This man is self-centered, self-absorbed, and always repeats the sins.
There you go.
And your premium went up, huh?
And my premium didn't even go up. Okay, next one, number four. Why do you think God repeats Nebuchadnezzar's fate by a voice from heaven? Notice right after his arrogant statement, verses 31 and 32, a voice from heaven came and said exactly the same thing as what? As the dream, as Daniel had just interpreted, right? The voice from heaven says, I'm going to tear you down, Nebuchadnezzar. You are going to go insane. You are going to hang around with the animals in the wild. Your hair is going to grow like the feathers of an eagle. And your nails are going to grow like talons, the talons of a bird. And you'll eat grass like the cattle. And only then will you come to your senses. Why do you think this time a voice from heaven? Penny. God is making it clearer and clearer each time the message comes, right? And Nebuchadnezzar has not learned the lesson. He's out there on the roof of his palace, arrogantly boasting about how he built the city. And so the Lord says, we've got to make this one unmistakable. And a voice came from heaven and said, this is going to be your fate. The Lord sometimes does that, doesn't he? He brings us the message again and again. Maybe, first of all, it comes from our own child when we're worried. Daddy, don't worry about it. And then maybe it comes from our spouse or a trusted friend. Why are you so worrisome? Then maybe it comes from our pastor. Why do you worry? Don't you know what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount? The voice comes through various methods, but it gets louder and louder, more directly from the Lord, right? Friend.
But how much more powerful it is when you hear a voice coming from heaven, or even if you're not a believer, coming from up there in lieu of a dream. Yes. Everybody has dreams, but you know, we don't always hear voices.
That's right.
You know, that are booming at us. So how much more powerful that would
yes.
be?
And this was a really unique one, right? Meant for this very powerful superpower.
I do that to Paul when he's sleeping. I stand over him.
Then he hears voices.
Yeah, it was so unique and so powerful to hear it from heaven itself, right? Linda.
Well, I think it's also similar to his other dream where he told people, you have to tell me my dream. Mm-hmm. And now God was just saying, I know your dream.
Yeah.
And so none of Nebuchadnezzar's other gods could tell him this is what was said before. So it's like the same God who speaks is the one who knows your mind.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, this was from the God, right? It wasn't coming from any of Nebuchadnezzar's other gods. And what is also interesting about what suddenly happens after the message comes from heaven? What happens very quickly after that? He immediately is afflicted with it, right? It's like God's getting the last word in before his mind becomes completely uncomprehending of anything.
It's interesting to note the description of what he will look like in this state, where he'll be unrecognizable, probably.
Yes.
So he has nobody that's going to help him. He's going to have to come to this realization and submit to God's will.
Yes.
And that's the only way it's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, he's going to look like some haggard homeless person, right? That nobody is going to recognize as the king of Babylon.
But Brent. The insanity, you think of, I mentioned to you last time, you know, the insanity of all things, he's going to go insane. You'd think he'd never come to realization of anything, if he's nuts.
Yes.
But he does.
Yeah. He becomes insane, a state in which, how could he ever come to the recognition of what he had done wrong? Your mind doesn't think clearly. Can you think of any reasons why the Lord would have worked in this way, given him such an extreme state of insanity?
He didn't come to his realization when he was in a perfectly state of sane. When he was sane, he never came to that realization.
Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar would never have come to the realization that he did, right? By himself. He was perfectly sane before, never came to this realization, has seen these wonderful miracles, the three men spared from the fiery furnace, has heard the interpretation of these dreams from Daniel, and he's just not working with God. Sometimes you kind of have to incapacitate a person in order to save them, right? I remember somebody, a pastor once using, when I was a child, using the analogy of what a lifeguard sometimes has to do. The person who's drowning fights against the lifeguard, and there's danger of that person dragging the lifeguard down. So the lifeguard tries to figure out some way of incapacitating the person so that he can save the person, right? In the same way, Nebuchadnezzar's huge ego was just uncontrollable with his mental faculties. There would have been nothing that you could have done with him to see the error of his ways. And later on, I think it's going to be interesting, the wording that he uses about how he came to his senses, how these things awaken in him. Let's go on to that section, because I don't want to spend too much time on 4. 5 is really our chapter. I read before as far as 33. So let's begin at 34. This is Daniel 4:34. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. And here's a poem then that Nebuchadnezzar wrote. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Let's consider the questions under the Friday study. Number one, using Bible helps find out as much as you can about Nebuchadnezzar's insane condition. This is a portion of Daniel that Bible skeptics have often questioned. Could this really have happened to the founder of the great Neo-Babylonian Empire? For those of you who've studied, did you find anything? Any history account that would reinforce the fact that Nebuchadnezzar went insane? Paul?
Yeah, there was a historian, a Babylon historian named Berosius, who centuries later wrote about King Nebuchadnezzar being in a total darkness. Mm. He is a state of total darkness where he didn't know anything. Mm.
Berosius was the name of this historian. But he was writing centuries after this time. Huh? But he spoke of a darkness that came upon Nebuchadnezzar. Did anyone else find anything?
I found something online, and I don't have the reference, but it basically said out of all the annals of him, there was a 7-year or time period where there's nothing recorded.
There is an empty spot in the annals of Nebuchadnezzar, a rather large spot that a 7-year period of insanity would fit into. But you can imagine, usually the kings were in charge of the annals of their reigns, and they tended not to write anything that would portray them in a negative light. So it probably is not surprising that we don't find any actual historical account of Nebuchadnezzar going insane except what Daniel records here. But see, that's how Bible skeptics will work. They will say, well, there's the rest of history is silent about this, so Daniel must have made this up, right? Well, they're just kind of denying the whole dynamics of how these kings work. So there really is silence about it, but there is enough of a hole in the annals of Nebuchadnezzar that this thing could have happened. I also came across in my Bible dictionary that that these kings becoming insane was not all that unusual. Ashurbanipal, who I think was in the Assyrian Empire, one of the kings, was also insane, as was Cambyses, who I believe was one of the kings in the Persian Empire. So royal insanity was not unheard of either, but there really is no further historical accounts that I was able to come across anywhere.
Well, and we have examples from our own presidents. I mean, Ronald Reagan was suffering from Alzheimer's, and that was kind of hid, and there were other numerous presidents who were sick or near dying, and they didn't tell the public. Mm-hmm.
Woodrow Wilson was near death at a crucial point in World War I, and his wife kept him secluded in a bedroom and would always be the one who gave answers for him and kept acting as if he was okay until that period passed. Joyce? George III, Joyce uses as an example. He was the king at the time of the American Revolution. After the time of the Revolution, had a period of insanity.
What are you going to write about him? Okay, he's out there eating grass again today. I mean, what kind of a log are you going to have
here?
Okay,
yeah.
He's nuts.
Well, Wayne.
Yeah, in the comments in my Bible, it says from Nebuchadnezzar's records, however, we can infer that for a time during his 43-year reign, he did not rule.
Oh, and there was even a period when it was clear he was not ruling. Yeah, you can assume that from his own account. Okay, good point. Let's go on to the second one. How do you think Nebuchadnezzar's sanity was restored? Did you notice the wording there in verse 34? I thought it was intriguing. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven. The ancient people would often speak this way about animals, by the way. Did that ever occur to you? Animals are often looking down, whereas human beings' anatomy makes it different, that they tend to look up. And he, acting like an animal, was down, and all of a sudden one day, I lifted my face to heaven. How does he say it again? At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. And then all of a sudden, he starts acting like a human being again because he begins to sing the praises of the Most High God. How do you think his sanity would have been restored? Paul.
Well, as quickly as it was lost by the power and purpose of God.
Yeah.
God's power and purpose was going to happen. It could happen quickly, it could happen slowly, but its purpose happened.
Both the beginning and the end are pictured as happening very suddenly, right? And it's obvious because of the whole context of the chapter that the Lord is the one behind this, right? The Lord's dream predicted it. It was the Lord who made him go insane. And even though Daniel is silent about it, I'm confident too. This was something that the Lord did. You don't just snap out of insanity all of a sudden, right? But Nebuchadnezzar did, and as he's waking up out of this sanity, he instantly breaks into this song of praise for the Lord. Let's go on to the next one. How is the theme of Daniel again highlighted in verse 35? We've had it before, and it keeps reoccurring through the chapters. Where is the theme of Daniel in verse 35? A little bit louder.
God does as he pleases,
right? You could make it that simple. he does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. That sums it up. God is in charge. The next one I thought was interesting. Take the final statement in verse 35 and apply it to the people of today. How do many of them ask the same question? How are they unjustified in asking the question? What is the question? Yeah, the question is, what have you done? Nebuchadnezzar is saying here, who has the right to ask God, what have you done? But the world today, that's still one of the most common phrases on their lips whenever God comes to their mind, right? If there is a God in heaven, why would he let something like this happen? Or they'll pray to him directly and say, what are you doing? That kind of attitude shows that the speaker of that question believes that he or she is in charge, right? And can draw God into question, can call him to account. I think the phrase that goes before it, as I was studying it in the Aramaic, boy, if they would translate these things more literally and more bluntly, no one can hold back his hand. What it really says there is no one can smite him on the hand. You know how God's hand is always pictured as he's doing great miracles. The question that's asked, or the statement that's made there is, no one can say, buddy, what you doing there? Get your hands off that. You see how it's much more frank in the original? And Nebuchadnezzar is saying, no one better dare do that to God. And say, stop it, buddy. Because whoever does that thinks they are God. That they're in control of the forces of nature. And they can call the shots. Right? And then he adds on that question. And who can say to him, what is it again? What have you done? That's a question that you parents ask your kids, right? When you walk into the room and there's cookie crumbs all over the floor. What have you done? Well, you're asking that because you're in charge. And there's a little bit of belittling that's going on when you ask that question, right? How dare we ask God that question? But man's arrogance is like Nebuchadnezzar's, isn't it? I'm in charge. Nebuchadnezzar learns his lesson, doesn't he? We have debated throughout Nebuchadnezzar's years, did he become a believer in the true God or not? Is that our final question? Yep. Let's go right to it again. Last one. Was Nebuchadnezzar a true believer in God when we last see him in the book of Daniel? Because this is where it leaves off. No more Nebuchadnezzar after this point. What do you think about that poem? What do you think about Nebuchadnezzar's comments? Does he believe in the God of the Jews or not? Linda says yes.
To me, it was the word now in verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt.
Okay. Now, something has changed in his life, right?
He had said good things about God before, mm-hmm. but it's now I'm doing it. Like, he recognized a change in him.
Good. Okay, even the little word now, Linda says. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven. There's been a change in his thinking.
Well, nothing is ever said that indicated that he trusted in God's mercy. And without the essence of trusting in God's mercy, there is no saving faith. Mm. And nothing indicated that he is totally submissive to God's mercy.
Because mm-hmm. look at the end of his comments in 37. Because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just. Paul is saying, I don't see any evidence that Nebuchadnezzar is trusting in God's grace there. The unbelievers can come to a sense that God is just and right, correct? But they might not admit that his mercy is what saves us. And even the last phrase there, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Well, is that a gracious act of God, or is that an act of God's law? That's law, right? And so Paul is concluding, because it ends on words that anybody affected by law could say, he's not a believer in the true God. Norma.
Well, also when you go back to verse 30, just a few verses back, he's got this uncontrolled pride, you know. Is this not the great Babylon? You know, he still can't see there that God is, can't see that God is sovereign. And that's just a couple of verses before, verse 30. I mean, it just...
That's true. It's very close to the end of his account where he still is ranting and raving with all of his arrogance. But of course, what do we need to keep in mind happened between 30 and the end? Yeah, and not just insanity, but how long?
7 years.
For 7 years the insanity lasted, right? So I don't know if we want to take 30 as our last indication of his mindset, but you certainly have to take it into account because this was a pretty big rock of arrogance to change if you're going to make the argument that he changed, right? That would have to be a huge shift, a cosmic shift in way of thinking, right? Any other evidence you see from his words?
I think of Thomas's statement, my Lord and my God. He truly understood that this was his Lord. Nebuchadnezzar never understood this is his only true Lord.
Remember that we have mentioned that so far in the book, the name Lord has never been used. And we described how the name Lord is that special name that Moses, that was revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai at the burning bush. The name that means I am who I am. That name was always used then when God established his covenant with the people. And, what is it? Exodus 34. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. He goes on with all his characteristics. There's 12 of them there or so, something like that. And one of them is, and he does not leave the guilty unpunished. That is part of his being as well. But most of the descriptions are of his grace and his mercy. And there's no evidence that Nebuchadnezzar understood that kind of Lord. Of course, we could make the argument too, well, why hasn't Daniel mentioned the Lord to him? Why hasn't anything come up in which it's been explained how gracious the Lord was to the Jewish people, how rebellious they had been? And that's the very reason why they were there captive in Babylon. Perhaps there are many things unrecorded in Daniel. I would think that Daniel would have explained those things to the king, spending years and years with him. And perhaps, you know, we only have 4 chapters of Scripture here. Maybe we're trying to answer a much too large question on the basis of only 4 chapters where you get to see Nebuchadnezzar.
I don't think that he was hearing God's grace and mercy, or that he even really fully understood at the end of how God is most sovereign. Because when we get to verse 36, he talks about my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. My counselors and my nobles seek me out. I mean, he's all about me again.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a little bit too much I in it, isn't there, in that chapter? I think Fran was next.
Well, but, you know, Pastor, I think that it's not saying that he came to be a, to know about Christ or any of this, but what it is that it, by him coming out of the insanity and recognizing that God is almighty and he is powerful, I would think then that he would seek out to find out more about him. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't say that, boom, he was zapped and his sanity was restored and he knew everything there was to know about God.
Yeah.
It just, I think the fact that he recognized that God is powerful, I would think that it would lead him into wanting to find out more.
It is a tantalizing account, right? We wish Daniel wouldn't have broken off here because, notice, there's no more accounts about stupid things that Nebuchadnezzar does either, right? after the 7 years of insanity, he doesn't go and set up another statue on the plain of Dura and try to, you know, it's silence, which may be a really good sign that he didn't do anything stupid after this, that he did inquire of Daniel, and that Daniel had a chance to tell him about the Lord of the Covenant. We really need to get, the handwriting is on the wall, which is really our chapter for today. So I'm going to take just one more on chapter 4, and then we need to get into 5. Penny?
I find it interesting how he says that God's ways are just after what he just went through.
Yes.
I thought that was intriguing.
He is definitely humbled, right?
Yeah,
that after suffering insanity for 7 years, he can say, God's ways are just. He wasn't asking that question anymore. What have you done? Right? He was done with that kind of thinking. So there was a certain belief in God that he had. I think that is undeniable. But how deep that knowledge of God was, I don't know if we can say more than we've just said.
I just wanted to say one thing, that in Psalms, I'll just read this one line. It said, I sought the Lord and he answered me. That's what I was referring to.
I sought the Lord and he answered me. It is true that when anybody cries out to the Lord always responds. And since Nebuchadnezzar came out of this insanity with this psalm of praise on his lips, the Lord must have responded to that in some way. Yeah. Okay, but let's get into our chapter for today, chapter 5. The writing on the wall. I had my Maddie, she likes to do projects, so I had her working on this yesterday. The handwriting on the wall. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. I think that was your Monday assignment. Let's look at the questions. At the beginning of this chapter, there is a sudden shift from King Nebuchadnezzar to King Belshazzar. Using Bible helps, find out as much as you can about Belshazzar. What did you find? Paul?
Well, about 30 years has passed, first of all. There's about a 30-year gap.
Yeah, there's a huge time gap between 4 and 5, about 30 years. Go on.
And then Belshazzar was he co-reigned with his father. His father obviously didn't like running the kingdom there in Babylon, so he was out doing his thing in trade and building canals and stuff. So his son pretty much ran things, which is Belshazzar.
Right.
So it was co-reigned. And they reigned for about 14 years. So that's some of the information.
Good. Yeah, we don't know a lot about Belshazzar. He was technically not the king of Babylon at this time. His father's name was Nabonidus. But Nabonidus spent time, my study showed that he was in Arabia for a long period of time, maybe as long as 10 years, and he left his son reign in his place in Babylon. Paul says, from what he read, their entire reign together was about 14 years. Okay, let's go on to the next one. List the insights that verse 2 gives you into the type of lifestyle that Belshazzar led. We hear a lot about lifestyles in California, especially this summer. What were the lifestyles like in Babylon?
It's kind of interesting. The first 4 verses, I think, drinking wine's mentioned 5 times. So they were pretty much partygoers.
They were drinkers. They were partiers. What else?
Multiple wives,
right? And even kind of some are wives, some are concubines. Concubine is a Latin term that simply means lying with. someone. So some he was, in some sense, legally married to, and other ones, well, they were just there in the palace for pleasure. Quite a lifestyle, huh?
Shows you what wine you do.
Wine, women, and the song you can imagine is there too. Anything else that you notice?
I thought it was interesting that some of the references I read, these parties were 1,000 people there. I mean, this was huge.
Yeah.
I mean, he would put on these where 1,000 guests would be there at these parties.
I think it is mentioned specifically for 1,000 people, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Oh, it's in verse 1? Yeah. For 1,000 people. So these were huge. And notice these, a lot of the nobles and things were there. So it's the people in the government that are used to this party type of lifestyle. Okay, third one. What can you learn about Belshazzar's religious beliefs from verses 3 and 4? He didn't have any, Jack said. Great. Idolatry, right?
Which,
yeah. There was a god for every substance on earth, it seems like, right? There's a god of gold for him, a god of silver, a god of bronze, a god of wood, a god of stone. And he praises these gods in connection with what? What brings it to his mind?
The gold goblets and silver he requested.
Yes. He brought out these goblets of gold and silver, and where did they come from? The temple in Jerusalem. When Nebuchadnezzar, the first king of Babylon, conquered Jerusalem, he destroyed the temple and took out of it the utensils of gold and silver and brought them to Babylon. That was told us in one of the very first verses of the book. And now we see that they kept those goblets, and at this time, Belshazzar must have thought they were kind of exquisite, and he says, let's take the royal, the sacred goblets of the Jewish people, and let's use them for our drinking party. So it shows that he has his own superstitious beliefs in gods that are connected with physical materials, and he also has kind of a despising attitude toward these peoples that he has conquered and their gods, right? Let's go on with the second section, 5 through 9.
One comment I thought was interesting. Martin Luther, when he was commenting on this particular verse, he mentioned, the human heart is an idol factory. I thought it was interesting.
A quote from Luther, the human heart is an idol factory. It finds a god in every substance or every idea that's out there in nature. 5 through 9. Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the palace, in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. The king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought, and said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. Let's take a look at the questions for Tuesday. Do you see any significance in the fact that a hand appeared and wrote out a sign, in contrast to the dreams of previous chapters? Ellie?
Well, this time he's awake. I mean, the others were dreams.
Okay.
And he's getting it fully awake. And for everybody to see.
Dreams take place at night when you're asleep. They're done privately. They're in your head. Now it's becoming more obvious for everyone to see. Anyone else have any other details? I purposely put the handwriting on the wall so that you think about it for a while before we address it. Because one thing that's really puzzling about the chapter is it doesn't tell until the very end of the chapter what the words were that were written. So I want you to puzzle over it during the lesson today before we address its meaning. I want you to be like Belshazzar. Well, what does this mean? Anything else on the fact that it's handwriting? Penny?
I think it's black and white. Mm-hmm. And it's also permanent.
There's a permanence with writing, isn't there? There's a finality that comes with writing. If a word is spoken, it's heard, the hearer will take it in, will do whatever the word, whatever the command is. But when you put something down in writing, you are trying to be precise, right? This is something that is established. And we were talking about how God gave the messages in Daniel in various media, and how it became clearer and clearer all the time. First there were dreams. Then there was a voice from heaven. Now there's handwriting on the wall. The Lord is making his messages clearer and clearer.
I think it's important that this is a sobering act. These people were probably pretty much blitzed, you know, drinking all this wine.
Yeah.
And this would sober you up pretty much when you see a visible sign of a hand coming from nowhere.
Having drunk so much, they probably at first were thinking, am I seeing things? But as they compared notes with one another, it was clear that this really had happened before them all, and it would have a sobering effect, right? Let's take the second question. Enchanters, astrologers, and diviners seem to have played a very important role in the Babylonian court. Do some thinking about why such men were consulted so often by the kings in the book of Daniel. And are there any advisors to rulers today who play a similar role? In almost every chapter, the astrologers, the diviners, the enchanters have been dragged out, and every time they're not able to answer what the sign is that's happening, or interpret the dream, and Daniel always has to come out the end. And it's almost like this is a script. What do they call that when you've got a script that just kind of follows somebody else's script, kind of a hackneyed script, that it's always going to happen the same way? Why in the Babylonian culture would you always drag out the enchanters and the astrologers when the king wants advice? Rosemary. Joyce, I think, mentioned to us last week that astrology really began in Babylon. Babylon is the cradle of astrology, the reading of the stars and trying to find out that the way the stars move in the heavens, does that have some message for us on Earth? And because this was kind of their baby, their way of getting messages from the gods, the rulers used them often. They were like political advisors. And I asked the question in there, do you see any similar way of getting advice by the leaders today?
Yes. It's one of the first thoughts I had when you were talking about bring these people out to help them make decisions. I think they weren't the sharpest knife in the drawer. They needed these people that were more worldly, more scholarly, had done more reading than maybe the kings of those days.
Yeah, that's true.
They needed them to help them make decisions, kind of like what we have today.
What often happens, especially when you have dynasties where the son takes on the kingdom from the father, Jim reminds us, you don't always get the sharpest knife in the drawer, right? In America, you can kind of weed out the weaklings with something like elections. Whereas there, you had to take whatever the previous king produced, right? And so maybe these people needed this expertise from these men.
They start very young, so they had
mm-hmm. Start as king very young, perhaps. Penny?
Even though our president still has a cabinet, and his advisors have different specialties that they know about to give advice to them.
The cabinet that the president has, right, is similar, where there are these advisors that are supposed to be specialists in these various areas to advise him. Norma.
I was wondering, could this be two from different nationalities or cultures if you're getting a big mixture?
It could be because, remember, Daniel and the three men were Jewish people who were brought into the mix. So perhaps the kings had gotten these advisors from all nationalities so that it represented the wisdom of the world by bringing them together. Paul?
I think they were totally spiritual advisors, not physical, but advisors that justified their means of their gods, the evil things they were doing.
Yes.
So it just justified their means of what they're doing.
They were spiritual advisors, first and foremost, and were justifying what their own evil gods were doing or were said to have been doing. One thing that really struck me about it is it seems to me that in postmodern America, there still is this grasping for advice from people who aren't necessarily the best experts technically. There's always a little bit of a desire for some spiritual wisdom. We've heard about it with various presidents who will go to psychics, or perhaps their wives will go to psychics, or there's this whole, sometimes the advisors are called things like gurus and that sort of thing. Well, a guru has connections with Eastern religion, right? And so often these advisors are not giving the best analytical, the most rational advice to our leaders, but there's often kind of a hint of a hidden type of wisdom that this advisor is supposed to bring, right? And a lot of times it has to do with the rapport that the ruler has with a particular advisor. It's their personal, the gelling of their personalities that will raise this advisor to a certain role. So I thought that was an interesting connection. It's not a real big point, though. So I think let's go on with the next one. Why do you think the king offered to make the interpreter of the writing the third highest ruler in the kingdom? Why the third highest?
You give away. The first and second were taken.
Yeah, first and second were taken. Some people have questioned that the book of Daniel doesn't know its history very well, and Belshazzar really wasn't the king, and the author got it mixed up. He wasn't writing under inspiration of the Holy Spirit, and he got that whole Belshazzar thing mixed up. Well, here's a hint that the writer of Daniel really did know that Belshazzar was the second in command, because the reward given to the one who could interpret the words was to be the third highest in the kingdom. Yes. Next one. Why do you think the Babylonian wise men consistently were unable to interpret the signs in the book of Daniel? This has almost become old hat for us now. The enchanters, astrologers, were not able to interpret. Why not, Carolyn? They were coming up with these interpretations on their own. They weren't giving God the credit. Obviously, why couldn't their means work? Who was giving these messages throughout Daniel? The true God, right? The Lord was giving the messages. So who only, obviously, would be able to interpret the messages of God? Someone from the Lord, right? Daniel, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Norma.
Chapter 2:22, it says, he reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness.
Yes. The Lord is a revealer of mysteries, right? That was told us in 2:22. He's the one who reveals it. And Daniel had said in chapter 2, only the one to whom the Lord reveals these things is going to be able to tell the king the meaning behind them. Let's go on to the Wednesday reading, 10 through 17. The queen, but look at in the footnote, that could also be the queen mother. And that'll fit in to our questions. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. O king, live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. this man, Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, Are you Daniel, the one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That's as far. No, one more. Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." I don't know if we need to go through this. It kind of recaps a lot of the story of Daniel. I don't know if we need to go through it all. Maybe just one question I would ask in connection with this. Why does the king, Belshazzar, not seem to know about Daniel? Carolyn. Yes. It was a long period of time, remember Paul told us that at the beginning, that has passed since the death of Nebuchadnezzar to the time of Belshazzar. And this is the end of Belshazzar's reign. This is going to be the last day of his reign. So it could have been as long as 50 years. So then, if the queen, as the footnote says, interprets it, queen mother, why would she be the one to recount all these things? Because she may have been there. There is some question, since it keeps saying that Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar, but the word son in Aramaic could be used quite broadly for a son, a grandson, or even a descendant. And so he, Belshazzar, is the son of this Nabonidus. And there is some question that maybe Nabonidus married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And if this was the queen mother then, this would be none other than Nebuchadnezzar's daughter who is speaking here and reminding her grandson, this is what, and that's maybe why she keeps saying, your father, Nebuchadnezzar. Your father, I say, she says at a certain point, she's trying to remind him of, this is my side of the family here, Sonny, who learned something out of all of this. And so that may be why this he has to be reminded. Wayne had a question.
You answered.
I answered, okay. Yeah, the word son can be used quite broadly in the Aramaic. Okay, any other questions about that section? Any of the specific questions that you wondered about? Laura? Very good point. Laura says, but Daniel was the chief of the astrologers back in Nebuchadnezzar's day. Why would he not be known today? Retirement, perhaps? Daniel evidently was quite old, I would think at least 70 at this time. This, if you want to date this event, this happened in 539 BC. And remember, I think we said Daniel came to Babylon in, was it 597? Or was it 605? Yes, 605 BC. So by this time, this is 66 years after Daniel was brought to Babylon as a boy. What's that? Oh, yours says 538. Our Concordia Self-Study Bible says 539. Yeah. It's hard, by the way, to determine years in the ancient world because you have to count so far back and you're dependent on comparing so many sources that years are often given. It could have happened in 538 or in 539. But 5:39 is about when it happened. I think our bell has rung. So we will pick it up there at Daniel 5:18 next time, and we'll leave the handwriting on the wall.
Oh, cute.
Leave you a wonder about it.